Welcome to Horangi Cybersecurity's Ask a CISO podcast. Come with us as we take a deep dive behind the scenes with the world's top cybersecurity leaders to get insights into security issues you care about. Before we take off, please help us grow by taking just a few seconds to like and subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and leave us a review letting us know what you think of the podcast and how we can improve.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Ask a CISO podcast powered by Horangi. I'm Jeremy Snyder, founder and CEO at Firetail and advisory board member at Horangi, and I'll be presenting our podcast this week. Before I introduce our guest, please don't forget to take a moment and like and subscribe or follow us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts and help us grow. Rate and review, you know what they say. It really does help. With me today is Steve Oren, federal CTO of Intel. Steve offers three decades of extraordinary success in a series of high-level roles at top-tier companies that include Intel Corporation, Sarvega, WatchFire, Sanctum, First Genetic Trust, Lockstar, and Sign Data Technologies. As Chief Technology Officer and Senior PE for Intel Corporation, Steve orchestrates and executes customer engagements in the federal space, overseeing the development of federal solution architectures to address challenges in government, enterprise, national security, and other areas of focus. Hello, Steve. Thanks so much for taking the time, and welcome to the Ask a CISO podcast.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Awesome. And we're really happy to have you. I'd really like to get different perspectives from people. You know, we talk to guests around the world and we talk to guests from a wide range of cybersecurity areas. And, you know, those different perspectives are something that I think are really great for us to hear with your background kind of spanning, well, spanning a long career that has seen a lot of change over the last, you know, 20, 30 years of technology, but also kind of enterprise and federal. I'm really curious to get your question and your perspectives. What are the biggest cybersecurity challenges faced by these types of organizations that you work with today? And, you know, how should we think about addressing them?
So, Jeremy, it's a really interesting question. And a lot of people think that there'd be unique attacks for each, you know, whether you're talking enterprise or federal government or global governments. And the reality is that the same three things that we keep hearing in all the press and in all the analyst reports that are targeting the major corporations are targeting everybody. And it comes down to ransomware. Everyone is still talking about it. It's still a massive issue. Data breaches, yep, and data exfiltration. And then probably the newest one in the last 5 years is supply chain threats, whether that, okay, be softer supply chain issues like we saw with SolarWinds and Log4j that continue. Yep. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Every couple of, yeah, weeks, we see yet another module that has gone from a vulnerability disclosure to an active exploit, or software that's been compromised at the vendor site that then is being used to do nefarious things on their client base. So I think supply chain threats and the broader concept of what's in the box and how it's being and how it can be compromised or can be, bring vulnerabilities along for the ride is going to continue to be an emerging and serious threat for us to be focusing on.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you said something there at the beginning of your answer. I mean, first of all, I agree. I mean, these are three huge areas. But you said something that I'd like to kind of unpack a little bit, which is that they're the same. You know, whether we're talking about enterprise, whether we're talking about government, we're really looking at the same attack vectors. We're looking at the same threats, et cetera. And I guess one of the things that I want to ask about is, you know, yes, supply chain is newer-ish, I guess, maybe. But, you know, SolarWinds was 2 years ago now. That the disclosure, and, you know, I think some of the investigation is now showing that the breach was even a year and a half prior to that, and there might have actually been some suspicion around it sooner than was previously disclosed with some of the latest information that's been trickling out. But I guess one of the questions that I have is, you know, these are threats that we have been hearing about for years. Why are we not getting better at addressing them?
So it's an interesting question there. I think the thing to understand is that the threat landscape, as far as, you know, ransomware as an attack vector, is constantly evolving. So the attack vector of what they're doing once they get in, once they get a hold of your data, is common, has been around. But it's a constantly evolving how they do it. And this goes back, okay, to why you can't play the whack-a-mole game with cybersecurity anymore. The idea of, well, I'm going to close that vulnerability and now I'm safe, isn't a viable option, because every time you whack one mole, another vulnerability pops up. And whether that vulnerability opens the door for a ransomware attack or a data breach, or it's a long persistent APT, if we take the viewpoint of we're going to just close every vulnerability, and that's the only mitigation that we have, that's not going to be a successful strategy. And that's why you see the industry adopt, you know, sort of moving towards this new strategy that's gotten a lot of buzz, and it's the hype scale, you know, is off the charts on zero trust. But if we pull back the hyperbole and pull back all the marketing and look at what's at the core, what they're basically saying is that the model we've used where we trust you once you're in, and then we kind of close vulnerabilities on the outside, is broken. And what zero trust is attempting to do is to say, don't trust you. Period. End of story. You are not trusted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now let's start to think about how do I apply security in that world where I'm not going to implicitly trust any person or any entity in my enterprise, in the inside of the walls, and then do start applying security controls based on that notion. So we're not there yet. This is going to be a journey, a marathon, if you will.
Yeah.
But when you go to the question, well, why is it still the same problem? It's because we've been applying the same basic concept of patch is the, you know, cybersecurity hygiene is the only answer. We got to patch everything. And again, that's when you're in firefighting mode, that's the thing that makes the most sense. The problem is that then you're in a cat and mouse game. So you close a vulnerability, the malware writers find a new one, and it's a constant battle. The way you get ahead of that threat curve is by changing the fundamentals. And so zero trust is one approach. It's not the only. I know everyone's talking about zero trust. That's going to save you. It's important, but it's one of the major strategic or philosophical changes that changes the whole game. I mean, there's several others.
Yeah.
About transparency as a mitigation or as a set of controls around supply chain threats. Again, with the supply chain, I close the log4j, so a new log4j or a new code cov or something else comes out, you're in the same whack-a-mole approach. Whereas if I get better transparency into what's coming into my enterprise from an asset inventory, from, you know, whether it be software bill of materials for my software, better transparency for my OEMs and what's in the hardware, and I can apply a risk set metric against all those parts, I can start to take back take control of my security. And that shift of giving you that visibility into what's in there or what's coming in allows you to make security decisions as opposed to waiting for a patch. And that, again, is a shift in strategy. So these fundamental shifts are happening literally now. So this is an exciting time in cybersecurity because we're seeing a shift in the approach. It's going to take us a couple of years to get our sea legs, if you will. But I think what we'll start to see is a completely different way of applying security controls, where we'll start tackling things like ransomware, not from a head-on whack-a-mole trying to block every family, but of making it inert in the first place. And I think that's going to be some of the exciting stuff we see moving forward, is how do we take the feet out from underneath the ransomware as opposed to the other way around.
But, you know, there's a couple things in what you said there that I want to dive in on. And you know, I'll just put the points out there and maybe we'll hit them all, maybe we won't. But one is on zero trust. One of the real challenges that I hear from people is, you know, okay, zero trust is a philosophy, as you said, but it's a continuous journey. And it's not just a, you know, right away I can, you know, kind of buy a zero trust solution. There is no kind of zero trust solution, despite what a number of vendors would tell you that their product does for you. We know that that's not really the case.
Correct.
You know, what you said is really right. It is trust no one, but then verify. The challenges that I've heard around zero trust are really that it then requires that you have very good, very continuous authentication and authorization systems. And then organizationally, it poses a secondary challenge, which is I need to be able to tell you what are the things I need access to. And that is a big problem in a lot of companies. I don't know on day one when I start my job as, you know, director of product marketing with insert organization name here, what data sets I'm going to need access to, what folders on, you know, the corporate file share system I'm going to need access to, et cetera. So that's one challenge I've seen around zero trust. Second, around kind of vulnerability management, I spent some time working for one of the leading vendors in the vulnerability management space. And one of the things that I could never wrap my head around, both at my time there and since, is we're in 2023. We're not in 1998 or 2001 or something like that. We don't have conflicts around DLL versions and things like that nearly as often. Don't get me wrong, it's not 100%, but we should all just turn on automated patching. And in fact, you know what? It should just be on across our entire fleet, servers and desktops. And people are terrified of turning it on the server side. Why? Because nobody wants to be the guy who broke production. I get that. So I'll be curious to get your perspective on that. And then the third one is around kind of risk management, risk assessment. Part of the challenge around a lot of these vulnerabilities, to your point, like, yes, we've had the same challenge around vulnerabilities for a long, long time, but your risk and my risk are not the same. We don't work in the same industries. We don't have the same regulatory compliance requirements. We don't have the same data sensitivity levels. We don't have the same network topology. So like doing accurate risk assessments around this stuff, I find to be very challenging in a lot of enterprises, because every enterprise is a snowflake, as you know, they're all unique. So I'm curious, you know, take those in any order you want. How do you talk to customers about trying to like come to grips with this?
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to try to make sure I hit all the key points. Let's start with Zero Trust with the journey there. And I think one of the mistakes that a lot of organizations make, and again, a lot of them go, well, I just need to buy my Zero Trust. Which vendor can I buy? Give me my checkbox. I can move on. And that's, again, the wrong approach. It is a journey. It's a continuous process. Just like you're doing continuous monitoring or continuous authentication, it's a continuous process. One of the key things about how do you make sure that you're applying it correctly, because again, like you said, product manager needs to access certain data files. There's two approaches that I've seen. Each one has their pros and cons. One is, okay, I think this is the better long-term strategy, but it takes more work, is when you start the process, and this is, by the way, something we should be doing even if there weren't Zero Trust. Get the business units in the room. Get the lines of business there for the policy creation so that you're understanding the flows of your applications and of your data and how business operates so that you apply security accordingly. And this is something that I've seen some CISOs in the past do a really good job of. And some of them, because they come from a background, you know, they were MBAs or they've been in on the factory floor. And so they understand how the, you know, what is the production line. So when they go back in to secure it, they know what, from what they're trying to secure. And they know what, you know, when someone needs to generate a port, there's these 20 databases distributed across the company that for once a year have to be accessed. Those kind of business flows, you don't, you know, sadly aren't written in a document someplace. It's not the good old days where you had a COBOL copybook that told you your business flow. And if you knew how to read COBOL, you could figure out the business flow. It's distributed. It's in combination of spaghetti code everywhere. So one mechanism that I've seen successful is include the business units and the what we call the roles, the personas in the room.
Yeah.
As part of, not after, oh, here's your security, go deal with it. It's as you're designing the security, you generate personas out of the people that are in the business unit today. You work with the lines of business to understand their flows and their needs and apply the security accordingly. And by the way, that's how you would apply a risk-based approach. So that you know that this is the production floor. This cannot crash.
Yeah.
This is the HR system. It can have a certain SLA. And making those risk determinations based not just on the risk to the data, but also the risk to the business. So one approach has been get them involved early and get them involved often. Make them part of the team. And that actually helps a lot. Because also, if something goes wrong, they're not escalating up to the CEO. They know exactly the guy to go call because they worked with him for the whole process. They can say, hey, Steve, this broke. Okay, I can go fix that. The other approach, which is cheaper, but it also has a lot more thrash in the system, is like you said, turn on the security and see what breaks. And what you'll find often is 80% of the stuff will just work like it did before.
Yeah.
It's those boundary cases that you just don't know because it's too hard to figure out every possible permutation, or it's like that once a year or once every 6 months report. And if you didn't happen to do your testing in that window, you didn't see it. And so it's turn it all on, break, just accept that things break. And the best practice there is information. So if you're not going to have the time or the resources to bring everyone in, inform that this is what's going on. Make sure everyone knows that this happens. And have an escalation path for when something does break, there's a well-communicated path for how to rectify. And that will help people, you know, so calm the nerves when things will ultimately break. And so I think those two strategies are the ones that I've seen applied. We're still early enough in the process where, you know, your mileage may vary, but a lot of it's like you said, your point later, each organization is its own beautiful unicorn. And so some will work better based on the organizational and cultural dynamics that you have. I found even within the federal government, bringing the business units or the mission area in the case of the government into the room for the security conversation has been very successful, and everyone works really well together. in other organizations, they don't have the sheer volume of resources necessary to take somebody out of mission. Yeah. Your job for 6 months is to work with security, and they've got a job to do too. And so I've seen both approaches, and they, like I said, they have pros and cons. So to your first point there, I think the key thing is pick a strategy and execute that strategy, whether it be get everyone on the team or be over-informed, you know, verbose in your information on what you're going to do, and have management know that there's going to be 20% of things will break or not work the way you expected it to, but that you have a plan. And that's the thing. Most executives know that the world isn't 100% working. But the thing they want to know that if something goes wrong, there's a pre-existing plan, and everyone knows the role to go make it, you know, within a certain period of time, make it better, to fix the problem. And those approaches, I think, go to your first one. I do want to hit something you mentioned before, because I've said this many times, both in private rooms and on stage, but about vulnerability management. And it really is about patching, and it's around turning on the security mitigations, locking down systems. We have the tools in CI/CD and in automation and Agile to automate security testing along with regular testing. We should be absolutely using it. And the reality is, we should be turning on every security, we should be pushing every patch. And if the CEO loses his email for 30 minutes, that's better than a data breach. And every CEO, if you ask the CEO, would you rather lose your email or lose the data on the front page of the New York Times, you know what they're gonna answer. So you just gotta be comfortable with that. Again, explain that this is happening, but you're, from a risk perspective, patching systems automated does two things. Number one, it closes your window of vulnerability much quicker. Number two, it allows your, you know, very small cyber team that you're already understaffed to focus on the harder problems and let the automation deal with the, what I call the stupid stuff, the 80% stuff. And two, it allows you to then focus on the things you can't patch. It allows you to focus on the, okay, the patch hasn't come from the vendor yet, but we know there's an exploit. What other controls can we put in place that require a little bit more work? I now have the time and energy to do it. And like you said, we are at the point where we have the technology to automate this and to automate the testing. We should not be breaking, you know, large scale applications, because you can run the same CI/CD, you know, automated test suite that you did when you put out a new functionality, run the patch through that same test suite. It may break certain things, and it just like a bug, you decide, okay, do I fix the bug? Or do I let it be a bug for that one time, and then we deal with it in that future case? We have to stop treating cybersecurity and vulnerabilities as this exquisite, weird art. It's a bug. We can fix bugs. We patch bugs. We do it in a normalized process. We should apply that process for this sort of table stakes cyber hygiene so that we can move on to the bigger problems, because the adversaries are expecting us to do the current process. They know that there's this long window of exposure between a vulnerability being disclosed or even being, you know, 0 day being identified and exploit being rapidly deployed. They know there's a 6 month minimum window before anyone.
Minimum 6 months.
That gives them a huge amount of time to get lots of value out of the vulnerable enterprises.
Totally, totally. And, you know, to me, the thing that, again, going back to my time working in this space, the thing, one of the things, one of the many things that really kind of made me want to bang my head against the wall was the fact that it's been 6 months for more than a decade. You know, you can look at that stat for, you know, what's the mean time between vulnerability reported to vulnerability remediated on a production system across the enterprise, and it's 6 months, and it has been for 10 plus years. And, you know, there is no reason that that should still be the case. And, you know, the other thing that I go back to, especially on endpoint systems, is, okay, so as you said, every CEO will choose to lose access to their email for 30 minutes as opposed to having the organization be breached. Great. There is almost nobody in the world who has only one device that they can work on anymore. You know, you've got, I'm sitting right here, and in front of me, I've got laptop, iPad, phone, and by the way, I have another iPad in the other room, you know, that's an older version, and probably almost everybody else does too. And I even have a Bluetooth keyboard if I really need to type because my laptop is unavailable. And if I don't have one, I can get one at Staples for $30, right? So it's not like you don't have workarounds to stay productive in the rare case that an automated patch borks your operating system and, you know, the system needs to be re-imaged or something like that. So yeah, you and I are 100% on the same page when it comes to this automated patching. I even think in cloud environments, you know, the excuse of not wanting to update systems in cloud environments is even lower, because really you shouldn't be treating your cloud environments like servers anyway. You should really be using a new operational approach to them and be cycling out the operating system versions and updating them on a regular basis anyway. But I want to come back to something around the first point that you raised with regards to zero trust. So you laid out these two strategies, and I have to say, you know, when I was listening to explain them, there was one that really jumped out to me, because to me it speaks to a broader problem that we have in enterprise cybersecurity, and that is communication. So in so many organizations, I go and I talk to different stakeholders, and one of the things you'll hear pretty consistently, you know, in my work, I work with both application teams and security teams. One of the things I hear consistently from the application teams is, oh, we hate working with the security team. Why? They're curmudgeons. They're the department of no. Insert, you know, the stereotype here, which, by the way, has also been the stereotype for like a decade. Mm-hmm. And I see you nodding. Maybe people listening to the audio won't see that. But I'm sure you've had that same kind of experience. And I really think that that approach you raised about kind of, you know, getting IT slash security to work with the business, that could be anyone, sales, marketing, product development, what have you, insert department function here, you know, to work with them to design what access levels should be in order to enable people to do their jobs is actually a great kind of icebreaker for a conversation. You know, these are not scary people on the other side of some, you know, proverbial glass wall separating the security operations center from the rest of the company, right? These are your coworkers. And you all have the same mission to push the organization forward. And so to the extent that you can have more of these exercises, I really do think that's a positive thing. And I wonder, like, have you worked with organizations where you've seen kind of positive organizational change as a result of kind of embarking down this path?
That's a really good point there, Jeremy, about how the working together changes the culture. And I've seen it in both the government space, I've seen it in Intel, and I've seen it in, you know, other verticals where one example from a financial company I worked with a number of years ago, they actually took the more extreme approach of taking their security people and putting them in the business. So most security teams like to stay centralized. You know, we got our central security team. They did the opposite. They distributed their team. They placed a security person in every key line of business as a permanent, you know, so for that role, I mean, that people would cycle through, but as a permanent role within that organization to be tied at the hip with that organization. That shift of moving away from the center of no to now we're putting our people in your worlds because we're not even going to ask you to come to us. We're going to come to you. That culture shift actually had a very big change because not only did it, you know, break that cycle of thinking of them as sort of that glass tower I can't deal with, I'm going to go around, but it also changed the way the conversation. So they were there early. When someone was going to try something, they could be part of the conversation of, well, maybe you don't want to build the application this way because this will make it harder for us to security test and that will add time to your resources. Let's do it this way that we've seen work in other places. And so they became very collaborative. And that collaboration then worked really well because now that's on the strategic side, so in the CISO's office, it's almost like they had little you know, tentacles out in all the business units to see what was working, what wasn't, so they could make better policies for the organization. At the same time, the individual business units stopped seeing security as the bad guy, started seeing them as enablers.
Yeah.
Now, it did take some training on the security people in two factors. One is, and one of the things that this CISO did, and I've seen, and I've done this as well, is they sent their people into the, you know, the what they call, you know, the first day of office kind of training for the business unit. So they basically learned, okay, you're going to go work in HR for, you know, so what does it mean to be an operator in HR? You're going to go work with sales. What are the sales force? What are the CRM tools? So they basically got some preliminary sort of 100, 200 level training on the environment that they were going to live in so they could be conversant in the vernacular. And then the other thing they did is they trained their people to not talk about, well, that's a vulnerability or that's a memory overflow, that's a heap condition. No. They talked about, okay, this is going to add extra time to your Gantt chart. This is going to be a bug that's going to have this memory resource. They told them that they helped them change the way they communicated about the security problem. So instead of it being an esoteric, weird security bug, it was in technical terms that it's going to be it's this kind of memory free problem, or in the case of the business unit side, it's going to add time to your development if you do it this way versus that way. So you put it in language that the business unit understood. And I think this comes to a key part of a flaw, if you will, in a lot of the strategic way people go about security for the enterprise. We're going to train all of our employees to be cybersecurity experts. That's a fail. Because number one, no one has time, and that's not their job, and they're never going to get there. So the idea of, well, if I can just train them to be good enough security people, we'll be secure, is a broken process. What you really want to do is train your cybersecurity people to understand the business better, because that allows us to apply better risks, allows us to work better with the teams, and to offload security from them in some respects. But the idea that I'm going to make everyone in the company a security guru, now you don't want them doing stupid things, but if you do it right, you know what? That person in sales can click the link and download the thing, and it shouldn't have catastrophic effects. That's where we should get to. We're not there. But the ideal state isn't that my salesperson doesn't click the link because they know better. I mean, that's a that's a short-term thinking. The long-term, where we need to get to and where the markets have to beat their vendors up to get them there, is where they can click the link for the, you know, as Bruce and I used to say, let them see the dancing pigs. But it's their protections are already in place with zero trust, with strong authentication, with everything else you're going to do, so that it doesn't actually cause the problem, so that you can download the malware and it's neutered out of the get-go. And that is the approach we need to get to. We're not there yet, and it's probably going to be years before we get there, but that way of thinking that it's not my user that's the problem, it's the technologies and the controls I'm putting in place are not yet where they need to be. That shift is how we're going to get to there. Because if we continue to say, oh, I'm just going to train my people, two things happen. Number one, people cycle through, so you have to constantly train them. And humans are humans. We're going to click the link by accident. We're going to get tricked. The phishings are getting so much better. And so that's a losing game. And so to back to your point, changing the culture from the security perspective of having them be the ones to learn a little bit more will help everyone shift that focus, so that we're collaborative, because that's really what we want. We want security and lines of business collaborating, because ultimately we want to be apply the right risks. You made a point earlier that I thought, again, it's the sad truth that we have 6-month vulnerability windows that are 20 years old, and we shouldn't be there anymore. We should be at the point where we're constantly patching and we're beyond that point. Part of the excuse you'll hear is, that was a 6-month window, I got the patch, but then another fire drill happened. And so I'm constantly dealing with the high priority ones, or at least what I perceived high priority, and the lower priority ones just keep getting pushed down the stack. One of the things we can do is we can take those ones that keep getting pushed down the stack and automate them. Just if they've been open for 6 months, automate. I mean, again, it's not perfect, but that's one way to close that ongoing gap, is that if you haven't dealt with it in 6 months, it's obviously not going to be that strategic to you. Patch it, be done, and then wait for the call. The other side of it is that we are really, as most organizations are not actually doing a great job at risk management. So it's understanding that, like you talk about, every company is different. So one company could be using a piece of software. Let's take something simple, Apache Tomcat web server, whatever, any web environment. It may be hosting the Office, pool for the NCAA, March Madness, our cash management system, same application, not the same risk profile. And so understanding what the asset is and where it fits into the business and for risk allows me to apply a policy. Now, here's the thing, the policy for that hosted Office pool may be just automatic patch, because if it goes down, you'll get some complaints, especially in late March, but no one's gonna care. It's not going to affect the business.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's the most critical application, you turn on all the testing you want in an automated fashion, and you verify that patch really well. Not that you wait on patching just because it's not a critical system. It's one way to apply that automation in a more tolerable way, is that if it's not mission critical, patch it automatically and have a defined process to how do you mitigate when somebody calls up and says, hey, I can't get my report. The flip side is for those really critical things that you're very hesitant to patch, you still patch it, but implement all the testing you would do to give you that level of comfort. Because the reality is people put updates on those systems every year. Whether they do it in 6-month cycles or they do it constantly in a good agile process, you are already adding risk to that application every time you push a new feature or close a bug. Security should be the same thing. It's a new feature bug in the sense that you're just adding to it. So you run the same test you would, get the same regression analysis, and move on. And that's a change in mindset that we need to have.
Yeah. For sure. It's a big change in mindset, and it's a change in mindset not only for the organization, but I really think, like, importantly for security teams. Because security teams often don't work that way, right? I mean, correct. There's a reason there's this perception of the Department of No. And I think, you know, something that you said really kind of hit me in the moment, which is sending the security teams out to get the training and onboarding into the different departments. And so often, again, you go in to talk to customers and you talk to everybody and you'll say, like, hey, what's the mission of this organization? And it'll be, you know, sell widgets, solve global hunger, whatever the mission of the organization is. But then you go to the, and you could go ask HR, sales, marketing, and you'll get a pretty consistent answer. You go to security and you get a very different answer. You know, 9 times out of 10, you go to security and you ask, hey, what's the mission of the organization? And they're like, well, either I don't know or I don't care, or, you know, my mission, not our mission, but my mission is to secure the organization, to prevent data from being exfiltrated. And so I feel like you often have this kind of mismatch in priorities across the organization, so that, you know, something again that you said earlier, security should be an enabling function. And then we've had a number of guests on here where we've actually had conversations that really around those lines, you know, security is an enabling function. And this whole model of, like, getting security out into the business to enable the business is, again, one that I don't think you see very regularly. You know, I spent the last 7 years of my career prior to starting Firetail working on cloud security. And, you know, people could at some point realize that cloud was not just a replacement IT infrastructure. It was actually something designed to enable you to move at whatever pace is right for you and give you all the flexibility so that if whatever you had was wrong, you know, from an infrastructure perspective, no problem. You can change. Really, you know, from 1 hour to the next, even from 1 minute to the next, you can change what you're running. But I don't think there is the perception of security either from outside or even from inside the security organizations that security should be an enabler. So I guess the question I'd like to ask you is, if you go and you talk to a CISO today, A, do you think that they perceive themselves as an enabling function or as a function that is really just designed for the purpose of security? And B, if you are trying to change their mindset, how do you get them to think about security as an enabler? What are some of the lessons or some of the messages that you would leave with them?
So let's start with the first point. I think more and more of the CISOs that I talk to in large and even medium-sized organizations across the federal government, because you have CISOs that are the, you know, head of, you know, the Army, it's a big organization. You have, you know, the Department of Interior, still a fairly medium-sized organization. And then you have, like, the International Trade Commission, a tiny organization, you know, 10 people in all of IT kind of thing. So you have the full gamut in the federal space. You see it also out in the private sector. And what you'll find is more and more CISOs in this modern era want to be an enabler. They recognize that that old mentality of, you know, the Department of No, or that I just have to stay in my glass tower and work from afar, just doesn't cut it anymore. And the reality is, because we're seeing security is actually no longer that thing that no one cares about. It's on the topic in the you know, in the boardroom. The C-suite understands risk better than they ever had. They don't understand cyber risk, but they understand risk to brand and risk to their business. They're talking differently. Compliance and regulations are having meaningful impacts on organizations that don't comply. And so the change in the dynamic has happened. So CISOs want to be an enabler. The successful ones have figured out how to navigate the internal culture and politics to be that enabler. And some of the mechanisms I've seen them use, number one, is dashboards for the board and C-suite, not for the CIO. I mean, the CIO has their blinking light dashboard. That's great. But a dashboard for the C-suite and for the board that doesn't have blinking lights and number of vulnerabilities closed, but has a mean uptime of key applications. Looking at it from a perspective of the board, how much reduction in risk did we get? How much reduction in costs? Like a set of metrics that are meaningful to the business. And then what they do, what the CIO does when he comes in with the CISO and does their, you know, their monthly or quarterly brief, is they map what they've done in security to the dashboard that the C-suite and the board have seen. And you see the dots get connected. Mean uptime means vulnerabilities have been patched. And that no exploit, you know, like you think about it from that inverse perspective, that's what they're showing. And so those successful ones are using the tools of their trade, but changing what information they and how they communicate the information. And one of the things that this has come up in a lot of different, you know, sort of panels that you see out there, a lot of the skills of a CISO today are not being the super uber guru on the hacks and the APTs. It's soft skills, being able to communicate to non-technical people, being able to convey information in a format that can be easily consumed, and being able to do risk cost analysis to against business risk, not cyber risk. And so those soft skills are actually some of the most important things to successful CISOs today, is how you communicate and how you manage risk at an enterprise scale, not just, you know, the risk of a particular component, but the risk to my business and how all these controls and the policies I create. Because one of the last things you want to do is create a security policy that seems super secure, but doesn't match to your business risk appetite. So now your costs will go through the roof and your actual value to the organization is going to be low. But when you map your security controls and countermeasures and training, everything to the business risk management criteria, and you have those in line, sometimes you want to have it a little bit higher because you always want to anticipate what's coming. But when they're in the same sphere, what you find is a much better and a much more successful, scalable organization that's deploying security, meeting the business risks, and exceeding it without the cost impact. And one of the things I've seen, and there's been some really good examples of this, is when CISOs have successfully done this, one of the things, and some analysts should do a report on this, is they've seen their budgets go up. That's one of the most interesting things, is that as CISOs have gotten better about communicating and mapping their security controls to the business risk and business risk appetite, they have found that their budgets go up. And the reason is because the people who apply the budget, the board and the C-suite, understand the value of the CISO and their organization.
Yeah.
And so they say, hey, I need to buy this, you know, multi-factor authentication suite to be able to do XYZW, because it allows us to reduce the risk here and keep this application uptime, or give, you know, allow you to have iPods and have Chromebooks and have laptops. And here's how I'm going to enable the business. That connection helps, and they see their budgets increase. And that's one of the things when I talk to CISOs, is understanding that in the fight for that extra percent of budget that everyone's constantly doing, those soft skills, that communication of value, is how you're going to ultimately be successful in growing your budget and growing your capacity. Not saying, well, I need 20 more cyber warriors because we got to go do red team analysis, but mapping what does that mean to the business unit. And so when I talk to CISOs about sort of their strategic imperatives, we talk a lot about, well, how do we map what we're doing in security to the mission objectives or the enterprise needs? And making that connection is really the mark of the successful CISOs. It's almost like going back to Jim Collins' book of Good to Great. You need a good to great for CISO. How do you move from just being a good CISO to a great CISO? It's when you transition from being a cybersecurity CISO to a business risk-based CISO.
Yeah, it's such a good point. You know, I think we talk about risk management, we talk about risk reduction, we talk about overall kind of management, because as we know in cybersecurity, you know, it's never 100% we are secure, you know, set it in stone, alert the presses and send out a press release. You know, no organization can kind of ever assume that, because we do know we have this kind of constant cat and mouse game with our adversaries, with the criminals that are out there looking to break into our organization, steal our IP, etc. But when we think about having an impact on risk reduction, and when we think about having an impact on enabling the business, we know that we're moving in a positive direction. We can generally feel good about it. And we also know, by the way, going back to a previous discussion we had, we're aligned with the mission of the organization. We are aligned with actually moving the overall organization and the goals of the organization forward. And that is really impactful and meaningful. Well, Steve, any last thoughts that you'd like to share with the audience? I think this is such a great point.
So, Jeremy, I just wanted to say that, you know, we've hit on one of the key things of how CISOs are going to be successful moving forward in this rapidly changing world, whether it be, you know, things like AI and new hacks. We're not going to solve every vulnerability, but when we apply things at that business risk level, it allows us to manage what we can handle today and then start closing those gaps in a timely fashion. I think that really comes down to, how do you strategically think about it and get out of the firefight and more into the fire management, if you will, to use that analogy.
Well, and reducing the risk of future fires, exactly. Right? I mean, I think that's got to be part of it. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Steve. I think that's a great note to end today's episode on. Thanks so much for taking the time and joining us on the podcast today, Steve. I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm sure our audience will as well. To those listening to the podcast, thank you for tuning in. Once again, this is the Ask a CISO podcast. My name is Jeremy, signing off for today.